You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Wharton Executive Education Podcast hosted by Alex Gromatsky. And today we'll be talking with Tomas Havizi, who is currently at Automation Anywhere, and he was previously at SAP. I actually met Tomas at Wharton back, I think, in 2016, and we graduated the same Wharton cohort together in 2017. So thank you for being on here today, Tomas. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Alex, so great to be here. It's exciting to see these podcasts take off.
I'm really excited to have you on. So let's get everyone familiar with you and the incredible things you've done. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your background?
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. I spent sort of half of my career in consulting and the second half in technology companies. And Automation Anywhere is a company I went to because I believe that technology should add value, and automation I thought made complete sense as we evolve as a society. We free up a lot of work. So I went to Automation Anywhere for idealistic reasons, from SAP, where I was for like 15 years. And I had a great run, great company. But in fact, Wharton was an influence in that. I had a passion for trying to do something smaller than large enterprise and pursue my idealistic passion, which was technology should be adding value, not just convenience. So I went through the Wharton course and said, hey, I think I'm going to change careers. And I did after that in 2018.
Oh, so Wharton's really sounds like it's life changing to some degree, at least career changing.
Life changing. Yes.
Yeah. And you were at SAP prior to that. What were you doing at SAP? You know, that a company like Automation Anywhere, you know, takes somebody like you on. It's a great company. So, you know, people that are wanting to, you know, follow your trajectory, career path, you know, younger Wharton graduates or something like that. How do you end up at a place like Automation Anywhere and SAP?
You know, it's interesting. I think SAP is one of those iconic companies in technology that is large enough to serve a lot of customers, but also has resources to let people experiment. So I was part of two experiments at SAP. So we started an organization called Value Engineering, which was basically shifting the focus from technical selling to value selling, which, like I said, is my passion. So I believe technology companies should think in customer outcomes, which in many ways Wharton reinforced in me. But also SAP at the time, this was like post-dot-com bubble around 2002 when I joined. SAP was sort of looking for their own way out of just being a large technology company, sort of making a difference. And one of the ways they did that is they started going to customers saying, "Hey, we're actually gonna think about how we can change your business." It's thinking in customer outcomes, which sounds so cliché-ish, but it doesn't happen enough, right? We started an organization called Value Engineering with like three people and ended up being a very large organization and sort of started a movement in technology. So now you see value advisors and value advisory kind of groups everywhere. But that was sort of the genesis of that whole conversation in tech, I believe, started SAP. So what's amazing is you had the sponsorship, the vision, and the insight. Bill McDermott at the time was the CEO, who's now at ServiceNow. So Bill created this atmosphere of let's innovate, let's find these areas where we change the customer relationship. And that's what we're part of. So that was half of my career at SAP. The other half was we said, hey, it's great that we talk to customers about their outcomes, but some customers care more and some less. And I stumbled upon private equity, and private equity is a lot about value creation. And a lot of the Wharton graduates either end up in private equity or our executive MBAs are in private equity. So we found this group of PE firms, about 140 of them we work with, that said, okay, we want to use technology as a lever for value. And it was sort of for my interest, my passion, that was home run. And so we did that. We did a really good build up of an organization at SAP to do that, to work with PE firms, use technology in their investment thesis, as they call it. And I think it's interesting. I mean, it's about me and who cares, right? But it's interesting for anybody from a Wharton cohorts, because private equity firms get more and more operational. And it's going to happen in this wave that's coming up next 2-3 years in the next economic downturn. And technology plays a bigger and bigger role. If you think about the last downturn with, 2008-09, right? A lot of the pure digital companies came out. Everything from Airbnb to Uber to, Netflix becoming digital, right? And private equity caught onto that trend. So SAP, so again, your question was about what I was doing, but we caught onto this idea back in 2003 that we should change that whole dialogue and have companies discover how technology can help them. Anyway, so that's what I was doing. And then Automation Anywhere is private equity owned. So some of my PE clients said, hey, why don't you come over here? And we have a lot better line of sight to value, which is, you put bots in and the bots can automate a lot of processes, make people's lives easier. So that's why I went from a large, massive company to a startup that's doing very well. So that's my boring and both boring and exciting story for me.
No, it's really interesting. So what's one of the biggest successes that you've seen, or what's one of the biggest lessons that you would have learned along your way?
I think so if I may indulge in I ended up this whole focus on technology and value, right? So I lived through the 1990s. I was in large ERP. I was a partner at EY, and we saw these massive projects, hundreds of people, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars spent on ERP or technology revamping. And it was great for business. It was great for me as a partner. But you started asking questions like, are we really moving the needle for our customers? Are they moving the needle for themselves, right? Is technology really helping for them to become a better business, right? And we all have soul searching. That was mine. There could be better soul searching activities, but that was mine. And I realized that what we should be doing is make the shift of talking about technology and just infrastructure and think about like how does it impact the end customer. And there were two things that influenced me, which again I think for the audience may be interesting, because we forget. So there were two movements back in the 90s in terms of businesses creating value. One was EVA. So EVA was enterprise value added. So if you weren't at a company as I did, Coca-Cola was a client, and everything you did in life, they had to justify saying, how is this adding value to shareholders? And it blew your mind, because all I'm trying to do is implement this financial accounting system. That no. How is this going to change your end customer? So your whole mentality was drilled into you saying, hey, how is this changing? So it was one big thing that when I walked away from Coca-Cola, I said, this is a great way to think. And you go to other companies, they don't think that way. And that was the day when Coca-Cola's stock was vertical. It's not anymore. And another company whose stock was going vertical was GE. And GE was a client, and everything was Six Sigma, as people know. And this was the heyday of GE. And everywhere you went, you had two conversations, which was amazing, right? So one conversation is, how can we make this thing better? No matter, even if the process went great, they're just constantly thinking like, can we make this better? Can we make this better? So it's sort of the opposite of am I adding value? It's just saying, can I tweak this? So I don't have to do big initiatives. I can just tweak things and make them better. But the other thing that GE taught us is, at the end of the day, everything's about talent. So anybody's familiar with GE, if you're not, it's worth looking into. They had this, they invented this concept of a 3x3 matrix of employee potential and performance. And if you're best, you're high performer, but also you have high potential and advancement. And if you think about these three things, economic value added, Six Sigma, like constant improvement, constant never-ending improvement, and you add that to it, optimizing talent, that sort of defined what I was looking for later on, is saying, can I find companies that want to have this kind of mindset? And it's shocking how few there are. But SAP at the time was like that, and Automation Anywhere is like that. So that became my journey, and stepping away from having 400 people billing for you at a client, and you're like, okay, is there all there is? And that was sort of the journey. I think all of us, and that's just my story, and this may be super boring for the listener, but I think all of us need to find that ultimate, whatever we get passionate about. And I think obviously schools like Wharton, but also our careers, actually enable us to go anywhere. We can be successful anywhere we go, and I think we're going to be most successful in areas where we are really fired up. And that sort of was my learning and out of all of that experience.
Awesome. And have you taken that, you know, learning from your career into your personal life as well, and have applied that, you know, marginality of increases personally into whether it's your health or, you know, your family or your own personal finances or things that you do at home and productivity?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm trying to answer it in a way that's probably relatable for others. I think quite a lot of every day about, like, what's the one thing that makes a difference for me? Like, what did I get excited? If I do this one thing, this day is already a cool day, and then everything else is going to happen. Because we all have our days full. We have meetings. We have all million things. So I'm one of those geeks that actually write down, this is the one thing I really want to do, because that's for me. That's what I want to accomplish. And sometimes those are big goals. Sometimes, you know, not a popular topic right now, but, you know, setting aside time for crypto last couple of years was like a big thing. Like, okay, I need to think about it. I need to learn about NFTs. It was my 2020 thing. Like, what the hell is this thing? So I think we all have to find our passion and make time for it, because I think we all get caught up and we get old and we like, okay, whatever happened to those 17 ideas? So I'm big on that. I think you need to think about, and that's not about customer outcomes. It's about your own outcomes. We don't get our outcomes, if you think about it, in business. If you left your, especially if you have big jobs, you know, you go through the day and then you have family and you're just like, that could be the outcome for somebody. But if you have these other passions, you have to make time for it. That's sort of what I learned, and keep that top of mind.
So you mentioned cryptos and NFTs and, you know, the .com bubble. So you've come across a lot of different, you know, things that were a lot of hype. Like, has there been something that you've come across where you're like, no, this is absolutely hype, like, this is like complete garbage, and you were either completely right or completely wrong?
You know, it's interesting. I thought, you know, I thought a lot about this because I was early in Bitcoin, and I thought, I got attracted to this for idealistic reasons. Like I said, this is going to be decentralized finance, it's going to transform the world, but not for the financial boom. And I think, so I went through a cycle with that. It's obviously, you know, it's neither here nor there for what people believe about that, but that was my reason, right? And then I saw people got into this purely for money, which is fine, but that wasn't my motivation. So I moved away. And then when NFT started, I said, this is another idealistic thing. Let's get the artists their worth. And then it became sort of a trading thing that had nothing with artists. So I found sometimes technology innovation hooks you, and then sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes for the wrong reasons. But then I had the flip side of it. It's like I completely missed the boat. I was one of those guys who completely missed the e-commerce, you know, hook. Like, I loved going to stores back in the late 90s. Like, I don't get this thing. Like, yeah, Amazon, fine. So you know, and that's a reflection time. Like, why does certain things hook you and others don't? And what I learned about myself is, I think what hooks you is something that aligns with your, you know, beliefs or things. And I'm very big on individual freedoms and that kind of stuff. So I thought, decentralization, oh my God, this is where the world is going. One thing I believed in that never happened is I thought back in 2010, 11, 12, when Ethereum came out, I thought we're going to see completely autonomous enterprises. I thought there are going to be startups running completely, as you know, some people remember there was this whole movement of DAOs, decentralized autonomous organization. So that's going to happen. Oh my God, everywhere we're going to go, there's going to be self-fulfilling or self-operating entities with the external agents, as we call them, oracles back in, I don't know if it's still the lingo, but that didn't happen. So I think there are things that, and I'm still passionate about it. I hope that happens one day where you just don't have to, have armies of people operate a business. But I think that's sort of where things are. And, and, um, And frankly, just looping it back to Wharton, I think, you and I were in, at Wharton sort of, for me, later in my career, for you, it's probably mid-career, right? I think these things are absolutely amazing. I know people ask me, I interviewed some folks that were going into MBA, right? And they say, hey, why do you do executive education? You guys have so much experience and all that. And I'm just like, you're missing the point. These are the reflection times. These are the times where you get to step back and sort of look at what you're doing and what matters, right? And I find it astonishing that a lot of people just don't take time out to think or just reflect or just get outside inputs. We all live in our little experience, and this is what we know how to do. And these kinds of things are disruptive. They're like, oh, this is interesting. How does it change the way I think about things? And I found it absolutely astonishing. And I give you a very specific example. And I don't know if you and I were in the same class, but just something like completely blew me away. I spent my whole career negotiating, right? It's because I was in sales or I was a partner in a big firm, right? So your whole life is like, this is how we negotiate. And we went into Dr. Schell's negotiation class at Wharton, right? And what's amazing is two things. So we had two different, I think one was the influence class, one was the negotiating class. And I remember talking to, there were folks from the Army, there were folks from the Navy SEALs, right? And the Army guy's attitude to negotiating was like, hey, we open the books. Everybody works on the same thing. There's nothing to hide. We don't hold anything closed. Like this is the reality. Let's work together on a solution. I'm like, coming from business, you go like, that's silly. But then since then, I had two, three situations where that became the negotiating approach. We were butting heads with customers. And we're like, you know what? Here's what I need to get out of this deal. And you tell me what you need to get out of this deal. Let's work together or something common ground. So you learn something completely unexpected in that kind of situation. And I think those are the reasons. Those are the reason these things matter. And what I learned from the SEALs is different. You know, negotiation class, they said, you know what? People lie. And when people lie, you die, right? So, okay, because you sort of assume people exaggerate and everything, but you say, you know what, in negotiation, people will lie to you. And then your assumptions shift. And we all know the type, but I think it happens less in business. But when it does happen, you're dealing with somebody who's completely going to throw you. So that was another way I thought about, okay, that's interesting. Do I trust the other person? How trust becomes so important, right? And then you question why you trust somebody, right? So I think these kinds of things sort of shape your career in completely unexpected ways. It's not the subject matter and the mechanics of business that you're learning from these kinds of things. For me, it was like there's other ways to think about the same situation you're dealing with.
Yeah, no, you start to question the way you're doing things and how you've been operating. So the reflection piece I really resonate with, because I would 100% agree with you that, you know, at some of the negotiation, I was just shocked to see the different negotiation styles and how real that really is, that people actually have different negotiation styles. And I came across a few different ones. And you know, until you really dissect it and be like, I just assumed everyone negotiated the way I did to some degree or largely. And to see also, you know, the mentality of some people, like they really just have to win and think that you lose, and others are more win-win. And it was just wild. So I really hear you on that. So you talked about reflection and trust a little bit. What's been like and values? What would you say are your core values? If you looked at that, or if you reflected on that at all, and how have those shaped over the years, from, you know, whether it's your upbringing or whether that's been your experiences at work? How has that changed over the years?
Yeah, you know, I was reflecting on this because I asked, you know, I get asked this a lot, and I had, you know, how I used to measure success is very different than how I measure success now, right? So in the 90s when I came out of school, and I think it's probably true for any MBA or any Wharton grad, right? It's like, let's go for titles. And I was the youngest partner at EY at 30, and by 35 I was hired as a CEO for a tech company, right? That was my mouth. So hey, that's what success means, right? And that becomes my value. It's like I measure that measure my career, my success, my existence in titles and stock options and comp, right? And then you go through that and you're like, and it's awesome, right? But you go through that and say, what do I really want to do? And so I think that kind of mentality by definition becomes about you. No matter how much you say, hey, I'm about adding value, I'm about that, it's not about that because you're wired to look for things where you get the next title, you get the next bump. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not making anybody wrong who does that. But for me, in terms of my values, to say I'm not spending time thinking about what others want. I didn't. I honest to God, my 90s, I wasn't thinking about what the customers want, what the employees wanted. I just like this is going to be my way. I'm going to find a way to get there, right? So I think some people never go through a value conflict, and I respect them. That's awesome. I did. I went like, okay, this is I'm struggling with this because I'm getting, you know, the trappings of success, but I wasn't enjoying it. And part of the reason was like, it really was all about me. And one thing, and it came, you know, I mentioned the experience with Coca-Cola and GE, but one thing that was, I had a partner at EY, the area managing partner. And I remember we were presenting and to a client. And if you've ever seen this, when tech companies are terrible at this, and consultants are different, right? But so we're sitting in a presentation. This was a tech company presenting, and EY was playing a role of selection committee. And I remember vendor after vendor, the only thing they ever talked about is themselves. This is how big the company is. This is what we've done. This is what our products are. This is what makes us different. Not a mention of the client. And we're sitting there saying, consultants are different because you don't present about yourself. You talk about the client issues, client problems, and I realized that's what my value is. My value is focusing on others and getting my reward out of that. So that became sort of a value shift for me. And that may not be the shift for others, but anybody going through that, I think it's worth reflection because sometime in your career, you're going to say, why am I not enjoying it? And it's funny. You talk about burnout, especially during COVID, was a lot of that. It's like people get burnout. And I think people get burnout if they have 20-hour days that doing stuff they don't like. If they have 20-hour days doing stuff they love, I don't think they have burnout. And it sounds cliche, but I think we as professionals need to reflect on that because the trappings, especially in business, of success are given to us versus we get to define. And I think we shift that and we say, I get to define that. And that's frankly an internal negotiation because there are trade-offs, right? Stock options are awesome, right? So you sort of decide, okay, that's what I want to do. And for me, that was an amazing shift. And I enjoyed a lot more of my 2000s than I enjoyed my 90s. Which is sort of interesting, I think. May be relevant for others.
Yeah, but would you say it's also, you know, I think early on in my career, very much focused on finances and success and whatever that meant to me, very self-centered, largely, I'd say, around my world and how I benefit from it. And then a shift came later on, but that was probably after I had some financial successes. But would you say it's a little bit, I don't know. I don't want to use the word unfair to say that, you know, it's easy in hindsight, you know, after you've done reasonably well financially to say, you know, now my values change, right? So what's your perspective on that? Like, if you go back in time, would you do it differently? Would you do it the same? And also maybe share a little bit about some of those experiences that you had. Like, did you enjoy your financial successes, so to speak? Like, did you travel? What are some of the things that you ended up doing? So a lot of questions in that.
So I didn't realize this is the philosophy podcast. Yeah. Yeah, like I love this. Yeah. And I think it's fair. I think it's you sort of have to have some financial freedom in order to explore your calling, right? So that's fair. But I do think I do think that's something that, you know, maybe that's why. But then you define your why. Why am I stuck in this role? You know, you're stuck in this role because ultimately, you're gonna get better. In fact, I forgot the guy's the comedian that was literally yesterday. I heard this like he was telling the audience about the advice his dad gave him. It's like a job is what you hate 20 hours a day to get to a position so you can do stuff you love. And I think it's, and this was the dad trying to talk him out of becoming a comedian and be a doctor like most Asian kids. This is an Asian guy. So I think what's I agree. I think you sort of have to do. You have to enjoy it, but also, I mean, you said something important. I think we all have to enjoy the milestones and say, I've come this far. How do I get benefit out of it? I had the good fortune of being able to take a year off twice in my career. And it's just a good time. And it happened to coincide with me, in my case, with my kids being born. So that was like perfect, right? Because in my value system, that's important. But I do think these are, at the stage I am, I think these are the things that I'm seeing in my daughters. Like they're quite, a couple of years into their career, they're like, oh, Dad, this is terrible. It's a burnout. I don't enjoy it. I want to do a startup. Like, no. You need to do a couple of years of this before you get to explore your calling. So, and this is the lesson I pass on. It's like, listen, this is the journey. This is what you're gonna go through, and you have to pay your dues, and that's part of it. However, if you ask yourself the questions, at least you're steering yourself in the right direction. And I wasn't. I was like, okay, I was clueless for 10 years. Like, oh, and I woke up one day and say, okay, this is not the way I want to go. But no matter what you do, at the end of the day, you got to work hard, because none of this thing works if you're idle. So grit matters, but it's, I think it's okay to expect a shift sometime, probably multiple shifts in a career, and that's okay. And that's okay. And one of the shifts could happen around, an MBA or a GMP or AFP, because those are reflective time. You're going to start reflecting. Part of the reason is you're going to be surrounded by people. I mean, you can cut it out of the podcast, Alex, but you were a very big influence on me, because I was looking at you and saying, this is amazing. Like your career and how you went through different kind of startups. You get exposed to other people, like I get exposed to you and some of the others in the class, and you started, hell, this is interesting. So they pursued this path. I was never thinking about that path. And that opens your eyes. And that's what people miss, I think, with executive education. It's not just what you learn, it's who you're learning with. And people get the network element of it, but it's also the models. You say, that's possible, that's possible, that's possible. They did that. That's pretty awesome. So I think it's it's good to reflect, it's good to expect the unexpected, and then very likely it will happen.
I totally hear what you're saying there, because diversity was thrown a lot around, the term, but I didn't really understand the importance of diversity from different industries, from different sectors, from different backgrounds, like you mentioned, Navy SEALs earlier, until I really learned with those different types of people that were excellent in their areas, and to then just kind of wrap your head around like how different people think, interact with them. It was really eye-opening for me as well to not just learn the content, but to learn with an excellent group of people from different industries that really the diversity component really showed. And so I really started to appreciate the term diversity for the first time after going through Wharton and seeing what people's career paths were like. And then you had mentioned kids briefly. I have a 10-year-old and a 2-year-old. I'm still trying to figure out, what do I want to, impart on them? You mentioned things like hard work and values, and I'm like, well, my son, he's 10 years old, like we want him to be really competitive in sports, but he's more of the social art type person, so trying to figure out how do you balance, because in my opinion, I feel that competitiveness and that hard work is really required in that specific area, because that was my path, but that doesn't mean that's going to be his path. You could be super social salesperson down the road and he's really loving and caring. So it's really interesting for you to mention kids as well, and how we have to respect their paths and what you're trying to impart onto your children. So thank you for sharing that on that as well. One thing I want to ask, how would you say, when you were, whether you were in your 20s, how has your life turned out differently than you thought it would, like 20 years ago?
It's a good question, and that relates to what we just talked about. I thought, and I had a good path towards that. I thought my career is going to be, hey, I'll be a partner in, when I'm 30, I'm going to be a senior partner when I'm, 40. I thought my life is going to be all in consulting. And I said, I already had it. I'm going to area managing partner. It sort of had it mapped out, saying, this is what I'm going to be doing, because those are the models ahead of me. And I could have done that. Right. So I said, And maybe that's, you know, and that there's nothing wrong with that answer. In some ways I look back and maybe if I wasn't distracted by my passions and values, would have been a path, right? But I was really, since I was in high school and college and looked at the consultants and advisors, I was in college and there was this group of consultants, some strategy consulting group came to us and gave the pitch and we spent time with them. They said, that's what I want to do. It's super cool. And they have leather binders and it's awesome. And you get hooked on something. Right. And I think it's a great journey. I still think a lot of my friends that stayed on that course had a great life. And I think the lesson for me is we have so many opportunities, right? So the path I took, I love, but the path I would have had, I would have loved probably for a different reason. I think the coulda, shoulda time people spend saying, you know, maybe I should have taken that job or should have said no to that one. And I don't think it's productive because in this world, this sounds cliche, but things change every day, as we know right now, right? So you can plan things out 20 years out, right? So going back to the kids topic, and one of the things, you know, my kids were fortunate. They went to a school where happened to be an all-girls school. They're both girls, and I appreciated this. They drilled into them, you need to think for yourself. And people are going to resist you thinking for yourself, not just because you're a girl, but because people do, right? So, you know, being a part of somebody else's plan is the norm, right? So if you say, hey, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, or I'm going to pursue my own way, or I'm going to do things my way, it's not something that gets rewarded early, but it has outsized rewards later, right? So I think in many ways, imparting that with the kids, what I've found is very useful because now I'm seeing them. They're very determined and they're young, right? And it's gonna help. Unfortunately, it helps them now in early career, but it was difficult when that's the value you want your kids, but they don't want you. You don't want them to argue with you. Argue with others. No. Don't not with me. No. I'm authority, but question authority elsewhere. But those are the things that are so important because, well, in my value system, not everybody. I respect people that say, you know what, just go stay the course and do what you're told. But because that word in my value system was, I'm seeing that in my kids and I'm like, this is awesome. But also, that's what I came to believe that what makes there used to be a joke saying nobody remembers in history the average person that just did what they were told. That's so true. And the same true in business, same in history, right? So not that any of us, I believe, stand out in times of history, but that's sort of the point. Like you want to have those moments because those are very rewarding in hindsight, not when it happens. I think you're hitting the wall like, why doesn't everybody believe in it? But in hindsight, I think those are the things that if you find them, they tend to be rewarding. It could be small things, could be big things. It doesn't really have to be super big.
What's something that, you know, sticks out to you, if anything, that, you know, something that you stuck to where you were unsure at the time? You're like, you know what, this is what I'm going to do, whether it's intuition or, you know, you took out a pen and paper, made a pros and cons list, you're either right or wrong in that decision.
Yeah, so one of my weaknesses, I'm not a pros and cons guy. I just go with gut. I think I said that earlier, and just because it's so current, I'm so bullish on whatever the Web 3.0 is going to be. And it's been around, I think the seeds of this have been around probably 15 plus years. And my lesson was like, I was on and off, you know, you get excited, you get disappointed, you get excited, you're disappointed. There's a whole new thing you didn't think about. But I still believe there's something in this blob of activity around, you know, everything from blockchain to virtual reality in those set of activities, something amazing is going to pop out. And I think it's on the cusp. I can't tell what the hell that is, but I think, you know, for me being in technology, you always like saying, okay, there is going to be a next Google coming out of this thing. And maybe it's going to be Zuckerberg being right about his efforts, but I think it's going to be different. It's going to be somebody who's going to completely change how we humans interact. And I don't know what it is. Can't foresee it. I don't have, and that also bugs me, but also keeps me interested because, and this is what's really interesting about innovation, right? And anybody, and I spend a lot of my time trying to like new business model innovation, right? I'm always attracted by movements that have a lot of following, but also a lot of headwind. And which is an interesting way what happened to blockchain and Bitcoins and NFTs and everything else is those kinds of things, how innovation looks. Innovation never looks like, oh my God, that's such a great idea. Let's everybody go behind it. It doesn't look like that. It always has all the incumbents resistance. And that tells me there's something there, but it could be a complete flop, right? So I'm completely fascinated by this, and I miss many of these trends. Like I said, e-commerce, what? I did that in California, Fry's Electronics Store. Why would you go on Amazon? Yeah, but there's no Fry's anymore. But those, you know, finding those, you know, looking out for those weakness signals, I'm big on that because, I mean, and Alex, you're good at this. I mean, you pick some of the, you know, the kind of things you got into, and it's like, You have an uncanny way of finding some of the weak signals. I'm sure you have your fair share of the ones that you didn't go after, or you went after and flopped. But I do think, I know ICOs you and I talked about didn't happen, but I think there's a lot to be said about looking for the weak signals versus the strong signals everybody believes in. So that's true.
I appreciate that answer because, yeah, something's on the verge. We don't know what it's going to be. And, you know, I just think about, I couldn't have imagined how much the world has already changed. And, you know, when my parents used to tell me, oh, you know, back in the day, we didn't have TVs and all this stuff. And now I talk to my son, I'm like, you know, we didn't have a Netflix and iPads and all those things.
What did you do all day?
Yeah, right. So they're going to tell their kids something, right? And then they're going to tell their kids, oh, and when I was growing up, I didn't have whatever the case is. So it's always something. But no, I appreciate your time today. Thank you for making that. This was awesome. And I just wanted to see if you had anything else you want to share here in our last few minutes and go from there.
No, this is great. I mean, in closing, I mean, one of the things you and I talked about before this recording was the one thing I did not foresee happening. Yeah. And it's really interesting because I'm trying to formulate it in a way so it's not divisive, right? But I thought internet is going to take us to a whole different place in terms of collaboration and unity and information sharing. And so, you know, I was an idealist. I thought, you know, and I came out of the East Bloc, and when Reagan went there and opened up, and like I thought that we're going to enter a wave of increasing global freedom and kind of thing, and I didn't see internet becoming sort of a highly divisive and segmented and siloed technology as it's dividing not only people but countries. I mean, they're just, you know, I think we're going to end up with a nationalized internet in some countries. So it's disappointing because I thought, in terms of social and economic change, in many ways, the internet enabled an amazing technology value creation and wealth creation. On the other hand, I think it's on the social side, it ended up in a completely different place that I imagined. And you know, regardless of which end of the political spectrum anybody is, they'll see the same symptoms, right? So it's unfortunate because I think. And down to the point of information being segmented and controlled and restricted and all of that. I think entrepreneurs, businesses, and us individuals, and we thrive when, you know, we get to share. And that's I found it disappointing that didn't happen. And maybe the next generation of Wardeners can turn the ship and fix it. So that was sort of my closing thought.
I love the optimism and idealism that you have. So thank you for sharing that.
All right. Alex, great to see you and great to talk to you today.
You too. Thank you.